Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a podcast brought to you by the Triad Network. This podcast is designed to share trending topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a behavioral and mental health perspective. Today's topic area is part of our Clinician Series podcast. In our regular podcast, we provide the coverage of a mental health topic of interest, and we find ourselves typically focused on the why behind or the why that drives the work being done in a specific area. The Clinician Series, however, is taking the discussion of topic areas a few steps further, specifically talking with experts not just about the why of their area of expertise, but we'll dive into a more practical, more hands-on, experiential understanding of the what and the how regarding the application of various therapeutic techniques, strategies, and constructs that we'll be presenting. The goal of the Clinician Series is to take our listeners behind the therapy door, to provide a look at and develop an appreciation for what actually occurs in the therapy session, including what gets said, patients' reactions, and the dynamic between the therapist-patient that can occur during the therapy hour.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today. I'm Dr. Graham Taylor, and today I'm joined by Mark Graham and Alethea Glaive. Mark is a licensed social worker and the Vice President and Manager of Program Services at Coordinated Behavioral Care. Mark was instrumental in the launch of CBC's Innovative Pathway Home Program, an evidence-based critical time intervention program that effectively transitions individuals with serious mental illness from intensive behavioral health settings to the community. The program, in fact, was a 2019 Heritage Provider Network Healthcare Innovation Award winner. Alethea Glaive has been working with Pathway Program since its beginning. Alethea is a licensed clinical social worker in the state of New York. She's worked with a wide range of issues from depression and anxiety to family and partner relationships, with a dedication of reaching Black and other communities of color. Mark, Alethea, welcome to our show today.
Thanks, Graham. It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Great to have you both. You know, Mark, I'm excited to have you back, and I'm so pleased, Alethea, that you are with us as we get to learn what you're doing through Pathway to address the needs of those transitioning from an institutional setting back into the community and how you kind of maintain their stability once they're back in the community itself. Today's show, folks, is part of our Clinicians series where we take you behind the proverbial therapist door to give you an insight into what happens within the therapeutic relationship within the various treatment settings that we work in. As we start out today, Alethea, we know about Mark from our first show where we learned what kind of brought him into the program. Mm-hmm. That was a great time. If you folks haven't heard that program, please go back and check that one out. He gives a great kind of in-depth understanding of the Pathway program. But Alethea, we would love to hear a little bit more about you and what in your life brought you to Pathway.
Sure. That was actually kind of happenstance. Mark found my resume somewhere and gave me a call. I did not apply to be a part of Pathway Home, but he kind of explained what the program was about over the phone. And I was like, sure, let's give it a try. We'll come in for an interview. And then I'm still here. So
couldn't leave. That's really great. I love when things like that happen. That's just kind of meant to be, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, I like that a lot. You know, if you would both allow me, I'd like to start today by sharing with our listeners the achievements of your program. And then I'd like to kind of reverse engineer our conversation, then to learn what you're all doing to reach these successes, how you make it happen. I had a chance in getting ready for our show today to read through your 2020 and your report. And I learned that you've all touched the lives of over 1,400 people this year. 95% of those you've helped remain in permanent housing. 95% of these people remain out of the hospital, out of discharge. 98% of them remain out of jail. And you've helped 476 of these folks secure permanent supportive housing units. I kind of feel like we could do a mic drop right now and just like walk out of the studio, the three of us together. Seriously, that's phenomenal, guys. It truly is. You're clearly doing some right things. And I guess as we kind of name those stats, let's kind of start here by going behind your guys' therapy door, if you will, by having you both share your understanding of the unique circumstances of the adults you work with, and what have you come to appreciate about them and their distinct needs?
I'll go first to jump in. It's a very interesting way of putting it, Graham, to look at where we have come. Pathway started, I think I told you last time around, as a grant-funded program, and it was originally just for 14 months. And we had this opportunity to work with state psychiatric patients returning back into the community. And as a population, unfortunately in New York, they have not had the most success on their reentry. And all too often, they were finding themselves back into our EDs, back into the hospitals, and then often transferred back into the state PCs. And so to hear the numbers that you talk about, you know, I'm very proud of them, but I'm very proud of the staff who enabled those individuals to make that transition. I think when I look at the cohort and when we started, I never would have envisioned that it would go 7 years later, that we would have grown in the way that we have. Wow. And part of the reason I had sort of my doubts was because I recognized the complexities for these individuals transitioning back. And a lot of the individuals, just through hearing from their psychiatrists, their therapists in the hospitals, those practitioners had very little faith that they would succeed when they returned back to the community. And we heard of people who'd been in 10, 15 years who were being referred out to our program. And I was skeptical if we would be able to make the impact needed for them to be able to live independently in the community. Yeah. And so, you know, as we talked about last time, we developed this care transition model, basing it on critical time intervention, making it very important that over 9 months, when we would provide these people with intensive support, but at the end of it, that they would be independent themselves, and that they would be able to manage and live in their communities with providers, with family, with friends, as normally as you and I do. And I think when you look at sort of the numbers we serve now on an annual basis, it is really truly back to sort of like, I call it back to basics. It's looking about adapting a model in creating a model, I should say, that enables us to really zone in on the person and person-centered care. And you introduced Alethea at the beginning and she talked, it's a little happenstance that we came together, but it's staff like her and other individuals who've been able to bring on board, who've been able to buy into the importance of putting the client at the center and supporting them through transition. And it's really that staffing patient relationship which is the underlying success of this program. And Alethea can probably chime in more.
I'd love to add on to that. I think for us, it's about the culture that we created at Pathway Home. I think when we started, everyone who was hired initially went into this thinking this was 9 months and this was all we had. And so everyone was super passionate and really wanted to get in there and see what kind of change we could make in 9 months. And I think that translated to everyone else that we ended up bringing on as we added more teams, as we had more success. And the culture still exists today on the the various teams. And that's something I would never want to let go of. We're not bogged down by all these regulations. And I think that gives us the flexibility to be people to people.
Yeah. I love that. You know, and it's funny, you're kind of starting out with a couple of things. In one of our other podcasts, we were talking about working with students within the school system. And we're talking about the Rosenthal effect. And as clinicians, we know that that's basically the expectations you have of folks that you work with. Chances are they're going to reach that. You know, the whole idea that, you know, it's Henry Ford that said, whether you think you can or you think you can't, either way, you're going to be right. Mm-hmm. So, hey, let's think that we can, or those working with folks, if we think that they can, and we set that bar and that expectation, that's how we think and we come into relationship with them. That's how we get to shape the ways that they think. And Mark, what you're saying is that, and there's really no judgment here professionally across lines, but sometimes clinicians, you know, that have been doing it kind of the old way only have this expectation given what they've done. And when we spoke about Pathway in our first conversation, you guys are way outside the box. I mean, you're doing some things that are like, what? But they're so effective and they're starting at some of the basic levels, aren't they, that make this outside the box approach allowing you guys to attain some of the statistics that you guys, that I just had a chance to read off from your annual report. Pretty amazing.
I would add to that, Graham, is that, and Alethea and I have talked about this often, when we get a new referral come into us, it often comes with a lot of psychosocials, past assessments. And when we started, reading through these, and we had sort of agreed as a team that we really wanted to reach those that had the most complex needs. And so we were seeing these reports of people documenting violence, a lot of negativity, like, oh, chronic alcohol user, substance use disorder. But then when we would go to meet the individual, we would set it aside. And in some part, we almost stopped reading so we could go and make our own assessment and our own judgment. Mm-hmm. And often what we found was the information contained in these documentations was old news. So we might be working with someone who's 50 years of age. This was from when they were 20. They had one assault charge, but since then there's never been anything, but it follows them. And often that label sticks with them. And for the person, it becomes their identity. But as community providers and therapists, we often judge them based on that information. And I think something we really strive to do was to actually just meet this person and get to know them for who they are and what it is that they want to do when they return back to the community.
Yeah, I really like that. Alethea, I want to ask you about that first encounter, but I want to kind of highlight something you're saying right there, Mark, that I think is, you know, there's different kinds of countertransference, you know, and countertransference are those things that get stirred up within us. This can be our own stuff. It can be a complementary countertransference. We're pulled into things, or there can be kind of an empathic or a concordant countertransference, but there's also something called an indirect countertransference. And that's when I learn about somebody before I actually meet them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the Rosenthal effect, it begins to set my mindset about how I'm going to see this person before I even know them. Maybe by something I've read or something I've been told, or, you know, I kind of go in kind of cautious or uncertain. And that kind of approach can shape from the very beginning, unknowingly and unintentionally, how things are going to go. So I'm curious for you, Alethea, when you come into a relationship with your clients, what is the first encounter like, and what are you thinking and intending in that interaction?
Yeah, sure. Our usual first encounters are at the hospital. And like Mark said, we talk about this all the time. I think what he just mentioned is something, our first conversation happened during my interview, actually, on that. And it's something we've talked about for the last 7 years, the identity that people come into because of the questions that they usually get asked.
Yeah.
And so when I go to the hospital or my staff goes to the hospital and you sit down with someone for the first time to try to get to know them, if you say something like, tell me about yourself or tell me who you are, the first thing out of their mouth is, I have bipolar disorder, or I'm bipolar, I'm schizophrenic. And that's something we immediately have to reframe and say that that's not who you are, that doesn't define you. And I think just those statements, people realize, oh, this might be something different than what I'm used to. Right. And for me, like, I'll go in and be like, what's the first thing you want to eat when you get out of here? Like, right. No, hospital food is terrible. Right. And mm-hmm. so you just open the door with these conversations of trying to get to know people without thinking about the checklist that you have to fill out on your assessment form. Like, I don't care about that when I'm going to meet with you. I want to know how I can help you.
I love that. Let's put the clinical stuff aside. And let's be two humans just sitting down together and saying, hey, what do you like to eat, or what's important to you? I really like that. What are some of those early exchanges like? I mean, they've kind of gone to go, don't you want to know my diagnosis? Or don't you want to know my history? And they're going to be probably a little offset here. What do they begin to share with you when you come at it that way?
I think for me, I like to make people laugh. Sometimes I don't even do it intentionally, but it just happens. And once that happens, it's like common ground. So we find various things to talk about, whether it's TV or a particular restaurant that they miss going to, or family, things like that. Because some people miss their family. And so we end up talking about these vast array of things just in day one, you know, and you're not even sure where it's going to come from. But you sit there and you go, what do you like to read? You know, ask questions that you wouldn't. It's almost like a first date. You sit there.
Like, I love that.
I don't want to know whether or not you want to be married and have children. Like, that's not the first question that I'm going to ask, right? Why'd you choose this restaurant? Right. Yeah. And so we're having those basic conversations with people. And I think for them, it's like, okay, this is different, because I've sat with people, with folks, and it's been, well, you have my paperwork, you know what's in there. And I'm like, that's not what I'm here to ask you about. And once I say that, it's like, all right, I can rock with this person. Let's see how this goes.
I think I've definitely had people look at me a little strange, like,
yeah,
and suspicious, going like, are you the therapist they were talking about? Because this is not what I was expecting.
Right.
Because they've been so ingrained to expect those array of questions that Alethea references and stuff. And I think when I've noticed it more, when I come back sometimes for the second visit, I see a smile from a person when I entered the ward, as I'm like, oh, it's almost like, there's my buddy. There's someone who's come into this hospital just to hear about me. You can't put a price on it in a way, because I do think it gets overlooked. And I think sometimes in our system, there's this rush to find out all the clinical details and background and stuff. But this is the stuff that enables you to work with that person when they come back into the community, and for them to actually feel engaged.
And it's about choice too, I think, because our program is voluntary. That's a whole nother side of it. You get to choose whether or not you want to work with us. And the choice is placed back in your hands.
Yeah, I like that. So these are all part of the trust building aspects of you coming into a relationship. And I would imagine for a lot of them, you guys may be the very first people that they could ever fully trust, or the ones that are willing to stay in relationship with them, no matter how rocky their course may be and how much instability they might show. You're kind of saying, hey, we're going to be alongside you in this if you'd like to have us alongside you. You guys may be the first people in those ways, aren't you?
Yeah.
I would say the trust is an interesting word, because I think it's very important in a therapeutic relationship. And you're spot on. There's a lot of people who, even initially when they work with us, they might laugh at our jokes, but they don't necessarily trust us at right. first. Yeah. There's almost, you have to sort of have an ability to sort of to follow through. And when they see you're there with the data coming home from the hospital and you're accompanying them home, and you're able to, you know, fix it, something in their apartment for them, little things like that, that's like, wow, you're willing to go a little bit above and beyond. You're not just here to ask me questions and to give me medication.
Yeah. You know, trust is really two things, isn't it? It's information and time. So I gather information about you over time and place and person and situations, and I begin to see this consistency in you. I can't accelerate it. I can't get more information out of you. I can't squeeze it out faster. And I need both of those things, but it's that consistency you're talking about, that people see us over time with the information that we bring about. We're concerned mostly about who you are and how we can come alongside you. That's it. Alethea, as I was going through the report, looking at the different populations you guys serve, I see that 46% of those you helped last year were white adults and 26 were Black. I know that you have a real dedication to reaching Black and other communities of color. Are there some unique challenges you could help us understand and needs being experienced by clients of color that you're working with that might be different maybe from those experienced by other populations?
Sure. Right off the bat, I would say, because the system is kind of designed by and for white folks, that one-size-fits-all approach does not work for people in Black communities and other communities of color. And because that's what they're usually faced with, there's an apprehension, there's a hesitancy. I don't know if I want to engage with this. Like, I don't know if as a Black man, I'm going to go into this clinic explaining that I have these feelings of depression and then I'm going to get diagnosed with schizophrenia because that's what the stats tell them. So I think there's a lot of that in the communities, which leads to like the fear around going into clinics or even going to therapy. I took a training recently called Decolonizing Therapy for Black Folks, and just talking through, you know, what the differences are within community and how community is important to us versus individuation and things of that nature. So I try to, working with my clients and with my staff, have those conversations, curtail things that are not designed specifically for us.
Yeah.
To work for us and then adapt new models and things of that nature.
That's really good. We'll be right back after word from our sponsor.
Behavioral and mental health professionals provide critical support to our communities in a time when our communities need it more than ever. But they need support too, to continue their education, to connect with colleagues, and to advance their career. And so we've launched Triad, the hub for behavioral and mental health professionals. At Triad, you'll find education, community, and career resources for both current and aspiring behavioral and mental health professionals, all curated specifically for you and all for free. Visit us at hellotriad.com/BHT to register for your free professional account. Again, that's hellotriad.com/BHT. Come join the community today.
Really good. Mark, what comes to mind for you?
I would sort of echo along the lines of what Alethea said.
Yeah.
I do feel that individuals of color that we come work with, I think there is probably more stigma placed upon them in our mental health system. I feel, just from my sort of years of experience, and as a white man, that the individuals coming from our state hospitals who are of color are almost considered, they're less likely to succeed. There's a lot of assumptions made that they're going to be on Medicaid benefits, they're going to be more drug prone and stuff. Yeah. And I think those assumptions, people don't dig a little deeper and look at the individual. There is that, again, sort of tarnishing with one brush. And I think it's a challenge that we need to, and I think Alethea is right. Our role in management, and Alethea runs a team, I think it's of 8 folks, is working with our staff on those same issues as well. How are you addressing it? What are you bringing in when you're really starting to work with someone? What are your preconceptions? And we need to be talking about that. It's not really just about the system, but it's also about us working. Yeah, we're all social workers. We're all well-intentioned.
Yes.
But we can have underlying biases that need to be recognized.
Alethea, if you'd allow me, that's some real good personal work. I'm going to ask you guys a little bit more about that later on. But how do you encourage folks to kind of mine down into a greater self-awareness of themselves so that they you know, are more conscious of and aware of? What am I bringing that I may not be aware of that could be shaping the interactions that I have? How do you do that with the folks you kind of supervise or work with?
So my approach is to be able to do that with them. I believe in modeling. And so it's not like, oh, hey guys, remember to talk about race with your clients. It's like, let's sit down and have a conversation as a team or in supervision about what your issues might be or what your biases are, or tell me stories that have affected you. And so we kind of cultivated and developed almost like a family aspect to the team.
I love that, people
can feel comfortable sharing those things. Because our team is made up of across the gamut. You know, we have Latinx, Black, whether it's Caribbean, African, or born in America. We have white folks, we have queer folks. And so we talk through these things and it gets uncomfortable. And yes, I tell people all the time, I love to say you have to get comfortable with the uncomfortable.
That's right.
If we're driving that at the top, it makes it easier when they go out there and they're talking to clients. Because a lot of times staff will come to me and say, my client doesn't want to work with me. He said, I'm not working with that white lady. Cool. Let's talk about that. How does that make you feel? Why do you think that person's saying that? Are you going to be able to have a conversation with them about that?
Yeah.
As opposed to just, oh, I need to switch clients. Like, we're not doing that. Mm-hmm.
Something else I would just sort of add to it in the work with the clients, the individuals we serve are not living in a bubble. And it's very easy just to maybe be in your comfort zone and to talk about, well, do you need benefits? Do you need support with this? Do you need assistance getting to a clinic? But there's so much happening in our country and in our community, as witnessed last year after George Floyd's murder, that our clients are experiencing and hearing and cause them anxiety and concern. And I feel like we fail them if we don't have those conversations. And they may be uncomfortable and people might say, well, that's not associated with their treatment.
Yeah.
But it's incredibly important because in my mind, it is part of their holistic recovery. And so I think we need to be encouraging our clinicians, our therapists, be having those conversations as you're working on other issues.
Yeah,
I really like that. You know, what I like, Alethea, that you're doing is you're encouraging us to get uncomfortable and lean into the messiness of kind of humanity and us trying to kind of just coming together, you know, with each other. And I love the idea of modeling that, because if we can't do that together, there's no way we can do that out in relationships of those that we're working with. It's not possible. I'm not going to turn on something, or it's not. So I love the idea that you're willing to sit with the uncomfortable, willing to sit with the honest, and letting people just understand that usually that's just based in fear of an unknowing, or maybe I'm going to be judged if I tell you that sometimes I don't like that population, or I have a bias in this way. And I would imagine a lot of your work is just kind of sitting with and normalizing some of this and allowing this to come out, and then just organically watching what happens as we're all sitting in a place of honesty.
For me, I think it even boils down to simple things like language, how you talk about a client when you're not with that client.
Absolutely. Right?
That's something I instituted on my team, was to have those conversations. And I brought a bell to our team meetings. And every time I heard something that, nope, that doesn't sit right, I'd ring it. And then we would rotate and have different people ringing the bell when they heard those things, so that people would, oh my, I shouldn't say that, right? Yeah. And then it got to the point where I would forget the bell, and then people would be like, I'm going to ding myself on that. I shouldn't have said that. Let's talk about that. But it worked. And to this day, we're having team meetings and staff are, oh, I shouldn't have said that. Nope, I'm sorry. Let's reframe it. And it really, really works.
Yeah, I really like that. I trusted that kind of honesty too. I would imagine kind of ripples over and gets generalized with the people that we work with. You guys say, hey, you know, maybe I'm kind of ignorant in that area, or maybe I don't understand it the way that you experience it. Help me, you know, help me know you. I don't know everything, but I sure would be open to learn. Yeah. And I kind of want to grow in that way with you. Alethea, do you find that there are unique aspects of working in this field as a woman?
Ooh, that's an interesting one. It's funny because this field is kind of dominated by women, right?
Okay.
But at the same time, it's dominated by mostly white women. And so for me, being a Black woman, there is that change and having to talk through things with folks on that topic. I think where it becomes, I guess, more tricky is as you're trying to get into management, because you'll take a look at, it looks like mostly women, but there's a lot of men at the top. It's not really reflecting what I'm seeing, like, with clients or what I'm seeing, like, down on the boots on the ground level. So, yeah, I would say that I do see some changes that need to happen in that realm of things. But I think there's just so much right now, much happening as it relates to gender and sexual orientation, race. Yeah. It's a lot to take in, but similar to what we were talking about before, I think you just have to confront it all, have those conversations with people about, you know, I feel like you're treating me differently because of my gender. Because I've been told, like, oh, you're complaining too much. And I'm like, am I, or you're too aggressive? Oh, is that what it is? Is that what it is? Because if I was a man, and I say it to people, if I was a man, would you be saying the same thing to me? Exactly. I have no qualms about those things. I'm very, like, in your face if I need to be. So, yeah, so, I mean, that's me in a nutshell, but I'm not fazed by those things. I confront them head on.
So you get that emotional muscle that allows you to have this voice that can be a necessary voice to address some of these things. Working in this field and with regard to what you bring, what's your superpower, do you think?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'm going to say, I would say probably my emotional intelligence. For this field, it's necessary, and I don't think a lot of people have that in their toolbox.
Yeah, that's really good. Mark, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I know. It's like, I'm glad you asked her that question. No, I was thinking if I had a super, there's something for me, and it's not really a power maybe, but it's belief.
Yes.
We have worked with, in Alethea and myself, with patients that I think everyone I enter into those psych hospitals and see, I believe they can make it in the community. And I say that, and I truly believe it. And so I think that's what has really sort of, with the whole sort of model that we have and the culture that we have built, is to me built around that belief that everyone with the right supports in the right time can make it in their communities and can become independent.
Yeah. So you're coming at it thinking, we're going to find a way or make a way.
Yeah.
We just got to hang in there long enough. Yeah. We're going to find a way or make a way.
I think some of it is exactly that. Like, it may not be perfect when a person comes out.
Yeah.
And, you know, perfection is the enemy of the good. It doesn't have to be what perfect might be for me. So what your living conditions might be or how you're functioning in your community might not be what I consider to be perfect, but it's good for you and it's working for you. And that should be encouraged.
Yeah, that's something Mark has definitely been on top of since the beginning. Like, even when we were in the pilot phase, Mark was always talking to us about what success looks like. And that what I think success looks like may not be what the client thinks success looks like. And it's about what the client views as successful for them.
Yeah. What a great way to let it be their lives that they're living and how we can make it be the best for them, not our interpretation or our shaping of it. You know, paint for us a picture of some of the settings you find yourself coming in, and kind of just in a nutshell, what a typical day might look like.
Let's say we get a referral for someone, CBC, that's Mark's team. They'll do the screening and then they'll assign to us. Hospital, like I said, usually the first engagement, we go on in there. And sometimes it's a little bit of a mess in terms of, hey, I had an appointment to come and see this person at this time. Then you're waiting outside and the door has to stay closed because of elopement risk and that whole thing. But then once you get in there, it's back to what we were talking about before. Yeah. You sit down, you meet with the person, you have that very first conversation. I think something that my team and I try to do is, before we leave, what's something that we know we're going to be working on or potentially bring for the client for the next time we come? So I know Mark has mentioned, like, bringing books back or things of that nature. We like to bring, like, little treats for people, whether it's like food from the outside or a book or something that they can use on unit. So sometimes you're visiting various hospitals or various units on the hospital, but that's the hospital side. When we're talking about going into the field to see where clients are, sometimes it's in the home, and that's very interesting depending on where they live. It could be a residence. Or sometimes we're like, we're going to meet on the corner in McDonald's at your clinic, because some people don't feel comfortable with you coming to their apartment or to their home.
Right.
And so we've learned to be super flexible. And it's like, oh, you don't want to meet here anymore? All right, let me meet you at the bus stop. And we're just so used to just being in the community.
Yeah.
And And something that I make sure the staff does is I don't like them to dress up. I don't need suits and ties. And no, you are part of the community. So wear comfortable clothes. You don't want the client to feel uncomfortable either. So we're going to hang out on the corner or we're going to eat a burger at McDonald's together. I don't need to have on high heels and a dress. Like, we're not doing that. You know, if that's how you want to dress, cool. But people are going to be like,
at work.
Jason, that's it's a really good point, because when I've worked for nonprofit organizations that have a dress code that require you to wear a button-down shirt and stuff, and to Lydia's point, we are spending time with people in their communities. Sure. And if I stand out because of the way I'm dressed, it labels that person. Look at that. They're getting support from obviously a social worker or a nurse.
That's
or
so good.
Someone's there. And so to make someone feel safe in their community and that they're is to dress down. And it's something that we do, I think, across all our teams. People wear their trainers and tracksuit bottoms and what have you. I think the other thing, just you had said at the beginning about looking behind the therapist's door.
Yeah.
Pathways of Model doesn't have a door, doesn't have four walls. The therapy is really delivered in the community. And to us, that's a really critical part of helping that person get towards independence. Because I think the therapy sessions that Lydia's team are doing can be over laundry. And some of the work that you're doing is helping that person learn those basic living skills, because they've been in a state hospital for 20 years. And in that time, we've almost made them dependent on care. And so her switch in the pathway approach is to move people, meet them where they're at, but how through your therapy, you're also helping them with daily living skills and the functions to become independent.
It's really good. I know that work of this nature is kind of long-term. What's the longest period of time you've worked with a client?
No, because it is a nine-month model.
Right.
That we work with that day. The person enters the community from a state PC is day one. And we really look to work with them over 9 months. And the first 3 months is very intensive. We're seeing them 4 or 5 days a week, which is why her teams have very small caseloads. And then gradually we wean the person off us, if you will. So where you've come from being a very sort of close professional friendship, that by month 9, the person's connected with other supports that they need in the community.
Got it.
Whatever that might be. But we don't, it's part of the reason we can keep accepting referrals. We do not have a wait list.
I totally get it.
So 9 months, there is a couple of people who've probably snuck to 12 months.
I would imagine they would. Come on. How good is that relationship to be in?
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. I think the people who did get to sneak in, though, I wouldn't even call it sneaking. It's, you know, you saw things going a certain way, and then sometimes month 8, month 9, some major thing happens that just upsets their life and everything. And we're not the type of people to be like, okay, cool, but we're at month 9. Good luck to you. It's like, you know, we're going to help you figure this out. When you're back to being in a good place, we can transition and move on. And so I actually like the stories of the people that end up staying longer, because it speaks to the dedication at Pathway.
I was going to say, there's some people who reach out to us months later and years later, not for therapy, but just they want us to know they're still doing okay.
Yeah.
And Lydia was talking about one recently about a lady that, she texts or calls.
Oh, she calls every holiday.
Oh, is that right? Isn't that nice?
Happy Thanksgiving, Merry Christmas. How are you guys doing? I just want you to know I'm doing well. I'm dating. I'm going to my program. All those things. But it's really nice to hear from folks long after, you know, they're no longer working with you.
That's just priceless. That is so beautiful. You know, in many ways, what you're talking about here, these relationships they're lifers, aren't they? In the best possible way. And you're going to hold a really special place in their hearts and in their minds and in their lives. And I can imagine they would want to call back and say, hey, look at what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And you guys getting to mirror them and kind of reassert the idea that, we're not surprised, but we're proud of you. We knew you could do it. And what a nice message to kind of further rebar their stability in.
Pardon the interruption, but we'll continue this conversation on our next episode. For more information about coordinated behavioral care and the Pathway Home program, please visit cbcare.org, where they've published a number of journals on the success of their transition program. We want to thank our guests, Mark Graham and Alethea Glave, for appearing on our show, and we thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. We look forward to having you join us next time on Behavioral Health Today. We appreciate all the support from our community. And if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Network, all rights reserved.